Psalm 63, if you'd turn there. We'll get there in a moment. We're going to spend some time in the Psalms. This morning was in the Proverbs. Tomorrow morning we'll be back in Proverbs. And tonight in Psalm 63, a little bit in Psalm 62. I want you to know that, again, this whole theme of fighting for faith is so important, and there's a lot of different directions we could go, but the one thing I hope you remember, and I'm just going to try and bring up some questions and get you guys to think a little bit about this, is that as men, we want to be men who fight for faith, and we don't want to be passive when it comes to our walk with Jesus. We talked the first night, Friday night, about fighting for faith in trouble and difficulties when they come in life, and they will. We heard from Billy a little bit of his journey with overcoming addiction. We've heard from Payne. Steve shared a little bit about some of the stuff that he's gone through with financial hardship and physical hardship. And every man in this room has a story, and we have to fight for faith. And then this morning we talked about overcoming sexual temptation. And it's just everywhere. I've had so many good conversations with people who said, yeah, it's just so much a part of our culture. I went and saw Avatar. How many of you guys have seen Avatar? Oh, so a lot, yeah. I went and saw Avatar with my son-in-law. We were up at Mammoth snowboarding a few weeks ago, and my wife and his wife, my daughter, did not want to go, and so we did the man thing, and we went and saw Avatar. I loved it, but as we were leaving, we were having this discussion, and I said, well, we liked the battle scenes, we talked about that, and I said, did you feel any of what I felt about Avatar? And, you know, he's my son-in-law, he likes me, but I'm still in charge, and he's a little leery around me and that sort of deal, And he says, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, what about the women? And he says, yeah. He says, isn't that weird? How can Hollywood make 8 feet blue women with tails look kind of attractive and seductive? And we both looked at each other like, yeah, that was kind of weird. And we had to come home and confess to our wives that that's the best part of Avatar is what we liked about it. It is everywhere, so we've got a battle on our hands. We've got to fight. I want you to know, again, in this fight for faith, I personally do not believe there are any formulas, that it's not simplistic. There's no one size fits all, that all of us will, as men, have to do battle with the different areas in our life and where Satan might attack us. And there's no formulas. God works in our hearts in different ways, and He shapes us in different ways. A few years back, I was developing my latest midlife crisis. My wife has told me that my whole life has been a midlife crisis. And that particular season, I was getting into rock climbing and ice climbing and that sort of thing. And there were some guys in our church who were very accomplished, and they were teaching me. And we went and climbed, after some training, Red Slate Mountain in the Sierras. It's on the east side, 13,142 feet. And it took us a day to get in, and we got to the base of this climb, and there's what's called a couloir. That's a French word that describes a narrow ice gully. The ice gully we climbed would be about the length of this pew. At certain points it would wide out, maybe be two pews, but it was 1,200 feet, which is a long way, about 60 degrees, which it wasn't, but it seemed like it was vertical. It was one of the scariest, most exhilarating things I've ever done in my life. You have crampons, the big spiky things on your boots, two ice axes, you're roped up to some other guys on your team, and we climbed this thing. It took us several hours. By the time we got to the top, I was absolutely euphoric. One of the highlights of my life. First of all, that I lived and I made it. It's one of those deals as you're climbing this, you look between your legs and you're looking down. By the time you get to the top, you're looking down 1,200 feet. Just trust me, it's a long ways. It seemed like 12,000 feet. As we're doing this, I'm thinking to myself, there's probably only three or four very famous, very accomplished mountaineers that have ever done this. And I'm now one of them. We get to the top, we take off our gear, we put it in our small packs, we do another rock climb, two pitches to get to the top. I'm so excited because I'm going to be one of the few people in the universe that has gotten to the top of this place. My name would be up there with the greats. And if you know anything about hiking or climbing, at the top of most Sierra peaks, there's a register. And I'm thinking, well, they'll just be a couple of names in there, and the name Steve Jolly will be in there. And we get up there, and I was the first guy to get over to the register, and you work around through the rocks, and at 13,142 feet, trust me, you can see everywhere throughout the Sierras, classic day, and I open up the register, and what do you think I read? Troop number 87, Fresno, California. and a list of 12-year-old boys. I learned a great lesson. There's more than one way to the top of a mountain. Richard Baxter, the great Puritan pastor, who wrote some wonderful works. And the Puritans, I love the Puritans, they're my heroes, but they at times were a bit narrow. And Baxter, at the end of his life, this great theological thinker, this great preacher, he said, "I finally realized that God does not break all men's hearts in the same way." So God will work in our lives in different ways, different fashions, and we need to be gentle with one another because our journeys towards Jesus and discipleship and obedience are not all the same, but it's the same Lord who draws us, and He'll do it in different ways, and it'll surprise a lot of us. Well, we're going to talk about David for a couple of moments here in Psalm 63, a little bit in Psalm 62. David, who is Israel's second king, as probably many of you know, he followed King Saul. He had what I would call a very up-and-down life. You know, sometimes you can read the Psalms and they seem quite victorious, and at points they are, but David is a man who really struggled. He was pursued by Saul, who wanted to kill him, for 14 years. That's a long time to be on the run. It's a long time to be an outlaw, especially when you think that you are God's anointed. He committed adultery with Bathsheba. That was a sin that plagued him the rest of his life, and because of that adultery, he ended up murdering her husband, Uriah. He had a son from that union, and the son from that union with Bathsheba ended up dying. He had a daughter named Tamar that was raped by one of his other sons from another spouse named Amnon. After that, David's oldest other son, Absalom, waits 2 years after the rape, and then he kills Amnon. Then Absalom starts a rebellion against his father's rule. Eventually dies a tragic death. At the bottom, this is a very dysfunctional family. David could not work for Focus on the Family. No way. David had a difficult life. And some of it was his own doing, his own mistakes, and some of it was not. It didn't have anything to do with him. And this is the guy that wrote the vast majority of the Psalms, the Psalter, the prayer book for believers throughout the ages. This is a guy who wrestled with pain. He asks in Psalm 73, why do the wicked prosper? And he just ponders this question. In a lot of the Psalms, he asks the why me question. What's going on here? Why am I suffering? And I would imagine there are a lot of guys in this room that can relate. You've struggled with your family of origin, dysfunction, maybe illness in your life, singleness or the pain of divorce, infertility. I'm sure in a room this size, there are many guys, especially as young boys, who maybe endured some sort of sexual abuse. Substance abuse has been an issue we've talked about a bit this weekend, and the list goes on and on of the things that plague us. In spite of David's problematic life, in the book of Acts, David is described by God as a man after God's own heart. And this is a guy who certainly didn't have it all together. But at one level, David had a successful spiritual life, a successful spiritual journey, even though there were failings and stumblings on along the way. He's a guy that fought for faith. Now, the question I want to ponder tonight for a few minutes with you out of Psalm 63 is, why was David a spiritual man? Now, how did David go about fighting for faith, for a warm relationship with God, in spite of all the stuff that transpired in his life? Now, almost nothing affects us more than our attitudes, and our attitudes really reflect our approach to life. And I'm thinking much bigger here than, you know, when your parents said, hey, have a good attitude or a bad attitude. It's bigger than that. David had a certain set of attitudes. David was a fighter for warmth with God, and he fought to know God because of his attitudes, and you see this in the Psalms. And I think the attitude that was central, that was key to David's walk with God, the way that he fought for a right relationship with God, is that he understood spiritual success and maturity as a longing or a desire for God. Whatever else you want to say about David, he was after it. He was a guy who was anxious to go hard after God. Psalm 84, just listen, verses 1 and 2. David says, "How lovely is your dwelling place, O Lord, O Lord God Almighty. My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God." David had an attitude, a longing, a desire to know God. Now look at Psalm 63. I hope your Bibles are open. Let's read first 8 verses together. And I want you to, if you're giving to underlining your Bibles, underline some of the words that point to this longing or desire that David has for God. David says it this way, "O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you, my body longs for you in a dry and a weary land where there is no water. I have seen you in the sanctuary, beheld your power and your glory. Because your love is better than life, my lips will glorify you. I will praise you as long as I live, and in your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied as with the richest of foods. With singing lips, my mouth will praise you. On my bed, I remember you. I think of you through the watches of the night, because you are my help. I sing in the shadow of your wings. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me." I want you to notice in these verses words like, "Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you. I love you better than life." David is a guy who, in the midst of this topsy-turvy life, went hard after God. Look at verse 1 again. You'll see the little phrase that David begins with, "O God, you are what? My God." 56 times in the Psalms that phrase comes up where David personalizes his relationship with God. "You are my God." It struck me today, I was on the ropes course, had a little time to think up on one of the platforms, and I thought, how many of the guys here this weekend have already given their lives to Jesus? And my guess is that many, if not most of you, already know Jesus. You've made a commitment to following Him and to trusting in Him for salvation and to living this new life that Jesus puts before us. But I'm guessing that there are some here who have yet to do that. And I want to encourage you until you make that step and that commitment and say, yeah, it's not just God out there, but this is my God. I'm placing my faith and my trust in this God. You'll never be able to understand what it is to fight for faith until you make that commitment. David had made that commitment. He'd made that jump. And this is not just any God. This is not some God out there, but this is the God that David knew personally. Psalm 27:4. "One thing I ask of the Lord, this is what I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to seek Him in His temple." And we might say, well, what the heck was so special about the temple? Was it just a church building, some ornate building? Why did David want to go to church? That wasn't it at all. David is seeking God in the temple because that's where the presence of God was. He wanted to be where God was, and God was in the temple. God's power and presence was there. And David says, I want to be there. I'm all about going hard after God. A huge part of David's longing, his desire for God, is to be found in verse 2. Would you look at it again? He says, "I've seen you in the sanctuary and beheld your power and your glory." David saw it. David got it. Now, here's my question for you tonight. Have you seen it? Do you have a clear vision of the greatness and the majesty and the beauty and the goodness and the glory of God? James just led us through some songs. We sang about how great is my God. How great is our God? A lot of the songs we've been singing this weekend are talking about the greatness of God. My question to you is, it's one thing to sing it, do we see it? A few years ago, because of my pride, some people in my church had a little intervention in my life. And they were saying, "Steve, it seems like when you read the Bible, we're not with the same translation. What's going on?" And what was happening was that as I was getting older, my eyes was getting worse, and I didn't want to wear glasses, and so I was just kind of going off memory, and I got it right a lot of the time. Sometimes I didn't get it right. I needed glasses. I made this great discovery. You get so much more out of the Bible when you actually can see it. It's awesome. Do you see it? Do you see God's glory? Do you have a clear vision of who God is? July 4th, 1952, a woman named Florence Chadwick attempted to be the first woman to swim from Long Beach to Catalina Island, about 22 miles. And she started on a summer day, and she was surrounded by boats. She was a tremendous athlete. And started the swim. She was in the water for 15 hours. She got within a half a mile of Catalina Island. I mean, she's done, you know, 99% of the swim. And she stopped, and the guys in the boats around her said, you know, do you need some food? Do you need some water? Are you cramping up? What's going on? And she broke down into tears because she couldn't see where she was going. Now, you see, on that particular day, it was one of these days we get in Southern California where the fog was thick all day long. And all for those 15 hours, every time she lifted to look to see where she was, she could only see a few feet. It was just a soup. And she broke down. Half mile from shore, they tried to keep her going. She said she kind of had an emotional breakdown. She got in the boats and she was done. A couple of months later, she came back on one of those days we get in California. Aren't you glad we live here? In the fall, when it seems like you can see 100 miles and the Santa Ana winds blow and it just clears it out and it warms up and it's just as good as it gets. And she got in the water at Long Beach and beat the standing men's record by 2 hours on the swim to Catalina. Killed it. And when she finished, I mean, no hesitation. She'd stop once in a while and look, and they said, you know, how'd you do it this time like this? And she said, oh. She said, I could see it. I told that story one time. I've told it several times. I think it's a great story. And a guy came up to me afterwards, and he said, you know, that's my grandmother, Florence Chadwick. She said, you got it right. That's exactly the way it goes. Guys, we have to fight for faith. And some of us are in a fog and we're totally out of sorts. We don't know if we're coming or going until we get a clear vision for how great this God is we talk about, for how absolutely mind-boggling salvation is, for how amazing forgiveness of sins is. Until we get a vision of that, we will never learn to fight for faith. So one of the things I want to encourage you with from David's psalm is to get this vision, to see his glory. So many men, as we've talked about already, are passive when it comes to God. Aggressive at work, disciplined about staying in shape maybe, eager for friendship and relationships, disciplined maybe in your money you like to invest, whatever it is, zealous about your music or your iPod or your iPhone or your Kinder book or whatever you got, all the stuff that's out there. You're zealous about that stuff. Oh, it's great to talk about that. It's great to spend time doing that. But when it comes to God, there's kind of like, well, I'm going to lay on the couch and just be passive. Hopefully the Holy Spirit will just grab me and pick me up. It doesn't work that way. David's genius is that he pursued God. He saw it. He stumbled, but he saw it. He fought to know God. Psalm 42, as the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for the living God. David was a guy who was hungry for God. Now, some of you might be thinking, ho-hum, Steve, so far, so good. Okay, I'm with you. David, he's a little unique. You know, he was the king. He wrote a lot of the Bible, and I'm not David. And I don't feel exactly like David felt. Sometimes I don't have that hunger for God. I don't have that zeal. Yes, I love God, and I've given my life to God, and I know Jesus, but there's not that that oomph. Is there anything you can do to develop the attitude that David had? Or are you just stuck? Are you just stuck saying, well, that's the way I am? God made David different, and you know, I'm the way I am, and I just don't have that zip, that zeal, that aggressiveness for God. I don't pant for God the way David panted for God. Is there anything you can do? And I think out of Psalm 63, the answer is yes. There's some real keys that if we get a hold of them are very practical for helping us have that sort of desire to be hungry for God. David, I believe, longed for and desired to be with God because he made two great discoveries in his life, maybe more. But out of Psalm 63, I just want to show you two. And if you make these discoveries in your life, I'm convinced it will revolutionize your zeal for Jesus and this ability to fight for faith. Discovery number one, we'll go through this very simply. David discovered that God alone satisfies. God alone is the one who satisfies the deepest longings in our life. When you are thirsty, what do you want? You know, I watched a bunch of guys play football earlier today out on the field, and you know, a couple of guys actually got sweaty. Good for you. You gave it a little work, and when you're all done, what do you want? You're thinking, man, I really like a big glass of milk. You want water. You want something that'll quench that thirst. That's why David uses the water imagery in Psalm 42, as the deer longs for flowing streams, my soul pants for you, O God. Jesus picks up this same theme. By the way, the theme of water is throughout the Scriptures, and Jesus picks this theme up in John 4. He talks to the woman at the well, and in verse 14, he says to this woman, "Whoever drinks the water I will give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." Jesus taught it. David discovered it. God alone is the one who satisfies. Now, I don't know if you've ever been lost in the backcountry hiking. It's only happened to me once. It was a bad experience. I never thought it would happen to me. I was hiking in the Santa Barbara backcountry with two other guys on a hot day. And we had small backpacks on, and we thought we knew where we were going. And we didn't. And we got hopelessly lost. Seriously lost. At first, it's funny. You make some jokes. And as you're walking all day long and in the midst of this chaparral, and it's hot, and you're not sure where you are, and you have nothing to drink. We got rid of all our water very early in the day, and finally it gets serious. We sat down and we say, okay, what do we have in our backpacks? You know what we had in our backpacks? It's very interesting. All we had, we could come up with, it had liquid in it, was two grapefruits. I hate grapefruit. What were we doing with grapefruit? And we hiked and we hiked and we hiked, and it got late in the day, and it became a very serious situation, and finally we came to a place called Indian Creek. And there it was. It was a small stream, but it was clean and it was flowing. It was so great. And we dove in to the water that satisfied. That's the picture that's painted in the Scriptures of a longing in our souls for something that will satisfy that deepest thirst. And David made this discovery. C.S. Lewis, at one point in his book, Reflections on the Psalms, refers to God. Lewis was a genius in making metaphors and such, and he says he refers to God as the all-satisfying object. Isn't that great? That's who God is. He's the all-satisfying object. Now, a question for you. Don't answer out loud or you'll embarrass yourself, but just think about it. What would it take to satisfy you in life? What would it take? How much money would satisfy you? Rockefeller, when he was some years ago the richest man in the world, was asked that question. And his answer was, always $1 more. How much for you? How much in your IRA? How much in your stocks, your portfolio, to say, enough, I'm satisfied? What about your relationships? Social interaction. How much would it take to satisfy you there? How many friends do you need? What about romance? What about, and I can't go much further with this, but sex, and sorry, gals, we'll just leave it there. But you know what I'm talking about, guys. How much would it take to satisfy you? What about employment? What job could you get that you'd say, oh, that's the job? Finally, I'm completely satisfied with my work life. David had unlimited opportunity in his life. Let's face it. He had multiple wives. He had multiple concubines. He had unlimited sexual opportunity. He had amazing wealth. This was the zenith of Israel's power. It was the height of Israel's existence. This is kind of the golden era. He has power and wealth and women and everything. And here we find that David says, none of that is enough. My soul pants and longs to be with God. I challenge you tonight to not be looking for satisfaction in the wrong places. To fight for faith and find your real satisfaction where the Scriptures tell us it is to be found. We're invited in Psalm 34, verse 8, to taste and see the goodness of the Lord. When we say that God alone satisfies, this means that God is where we find our ultimate joy. Now trust me, there's all kinds of other joys in life. There's the physical pleasures of life and your hobbies and your sports and your families and these are all good things. They're good gifts from God. But what the problem is, so many men place primary importance on those things and not the most important thing, that's God. C.S. Lewis again, let me give you a quote. I wish I'd put it up on the screen earlier, but it's too late, so you're going to have to stay with me and put your thinking caps on here. It's a little long, and if you've heard my brother teach or Ben Patterson teach, undoubtedly at some point they've shared it. It's become a quote that we've used often in our church to make this point. But Lewis puts it this way. If we consider the unblushing promise of reward and the staggering nature of rewards promised in the Gospels, it seems, that our Lord finds our desires not only not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling around with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered to us. Like an ignorant child who goes on making mud pies in the slum because he cannot understand what is meant by a holiday at the sea, we are far too easily pleased. And so I would ask you the question tonight, guys, have you become too easily pleased in your life with just stuff? Not bad stuff, just stuff, things. And maybe one of the reasons you're not fighting for faith is that you've not found that satisfaction in God alone. When I was a young boy, I was born in Santa Monica. And I started surfing as a kid. My dad was into surfing and my family was a beach family. And I had a surfboard that I kept at the Santa Monica Pier. And I kept it in a locker called Eli's Locker. I think it cost me $3 a month to keep my surfboard there. And I'd make my way down to the beach and I was so little at 12, and this is when surfboards were really big and heavy, I couldn't carry it. So I'd get it out of this locker, and I'd drag it, first across the cement and then across the sand. I'd drag it down to the beach with a couple of my little buddies, and we'd surf at the Santa Monica Pier. I want you to know, in all of California, possibly all of the world, the Santa Monica Pier is the worst place for surfing in the world. It's horrible. Yeah. You know? The water is polluted. The waves are never good, ever. But you know what? For a 12-year-old boy, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I couldn't imagine anything better. It was so great. Every day, all year long, down to the beach to get in these crummy, dirty, closed-out little Santa Monica waves. And then one day, a little friend of mine, whose dad also is a surfer, said, hey, my dad's going to take us somewhere else. I didn't know there was anywhere else to surf. I thought this was the, you know, be-all and end-all of the surfing world. He says, we're going on a big trip. We're going to Malibu. Malibu? I'd heard about it, but I couldn't envision it. We got in my little friend's dad's car, and he took us to Malibu, and I'll never forget, it was a hot summer day and there was a south swell going. I'd never seen waves like this in my life. I managed somehow as a little guy to get out there, and I finally caught one and had the most incredible experience of my life riding this wave. I want you to know my life was changed forever. It was a conversion experience. I think there's a lot of men in my church, and I think in your church, that are hanging around at the Santa Monica Pier spiritually, when there's so much more out there. You can go to Malibu or Hawaii or wherever you want to go. Sometimes we're men who just settle for less. Jonathan Edwards, the great 18th century pastor and theologian, put it this way: the enjoyment of God is the only happiness with which our souls can be satisfied. To go to heaven, to fully enjoy God, is infinitely better than the most pleasant accommodations here on earth. Fathers and mothers, husbands and wives, children, or the company of earthly friends are but shadows. But God is the substance. These are but scattered beams, but God is the sun. These are but streams, but God is the ocean. Edwards was the great theologian of the glory of God and finding our joy and our happiness and our satisfaction in God. Do you guys know the word satiated? I don't think it's a word we use a whole lot in regular language. It's a fascinating word. To be satiated means to be filled up so much that you no longer have an appetite. And if I've watched the guys in my church, I realize that a lot of them are so satiated with stuff. Soccer games, AYSO, business commitments, social engagements, hobbies, their triathlon they want to do, their investments they're into, all the stuff of life. They're so filled up that there is no hunger for God. David made this great discovery that God alone satisfies. But if we're so full, I mean, how many of you guys have maybe gone and had an invitation out to a dinner, and you're going to go to a great dinner, but around 4 or 5 in the afternoon, you're kind of hungry, and you start nibbling in the kitchen? This happens to me all the time. And my wife yells at me. She says, "Don't, we're going out to a great dinner, but I'm hungry now." And so I eat crackers, a few Triscuits, you know, some crummy cheese, and, you know, some chips. I mean, chips are always good, you know, but do some chips. And by the time we go to dinner, guess who's not hungry? Me. Because I've eaten a bunch of stuff that's either just okay or it's junky. And the real meal, the real stuff, goes uneaten. I think that describes a lot of guys' Christians' lives. My guess is this is a room full of busy men. There's a lot in your lives for the most part. The danger is that we would fill up our lives with so much, I'll just call it stuff, that there's no hunger, there's no room for God. David makes a second discovery. His second discovery is not only that God alone satisfies, but secondly, that God alone provides security. We spend a lot of time in our quest for security, don't we? Everybody wants security, and we want to strategize to cover all our bases. At times, we will even cheat on our own principles and our own beliefs to ensure that we have some security. I read an interesting quote the other day from a philosopher who is an atheist. His name is Alistair MacIntyre, and he said, "There is no God," emphatically, as an atheist. He says, "There's no God, but it is wise to pray to him from time to time." I think we do the same thing. We want security, and we'll cheat on our principles. Look across the page to Psalm 62. I still hope you have your Bibles open. We've looked a little bit at Psalm 63, but Psalm 62, David says, "My soul finds rest in God alone. My salvation comes from Him. He alone is my rock and my salvation. He is my fortress. I will never be shaken." Again, if you underline your Bibles, rest, salvation, rock, fortress, pictures of David finding his security in God alone. And trust me, David was well aware of the temptation to find security elsewhere. Let's keep reading in Psalm 62. How long will you assault a man? Would you throw him down this leaning wall, this tottering fence? David is pondering those who are after him, his enemies. They fully intend to topple him from his lofty place. They take delight in lies. With their mouths they bless, but in their hearts they curse. Now what? It gives a resolution. David, many times we're inside a kind of a personal diary. And here's the resolution. Find rest, O my soul, in God alone. Security. My hope comes from Him. He alone is my rock and my salvation. He is my fortress. I will not be shaken. My salvation and my honor depend on God. He is my mighty rock, my refuge. And now in verse 8, we get an invitation. Trust in Him at all times, O people. Pour out your hearts to Him, for God is our refuge. Stick with me on this one, and I hope I'm not misunderstood. To believe in God, to have faith in God for your salvation, is not necessarily the same thing as trusting in God for your daily life. I think there's a tendency that a lot of guys will get born again, converted, saved, however you want to phrase it. The New Testament uses lots of pictures of this event. But they'll come to God, a right relationship with God. They know God. They trust God. They have faith in God. They believe in God. And then they go and they live their life with a lack of trust, with a lack of faith, with a lack of dependency. They're saved. They're in the kingdom. They know they're going to heaven. But then they go on and they have a whole other life that leave God out of the equation for security. All of us have a longing to trust in something that is greater than ourselves. It's just at times hard to do. Trust doesn't come easily, especially for men. But this is the genius of David. He made this great discovery in trusting in God alone. I mentioned earlier my rock climbing, mountain climbing midlife crisis, one of them, and rock climbing is difficult. It's really scary. If you've never tried it, I would encourage you to give it a try. And it's something that really, you know, there's a lot of pictures of the Christian life in rock climbing. And when I first started rock climbing, you start usually by somebody top roping you. And what it means is somebody might climb up a back section of a rock and set it up an anchor. And they would lower the rope over and they look way down and you'd be at the bottom and you climb up and they have you on the rope. It's really quite safe if it's done correctly. The trouble is, it doesn't feel safe. If you've ever been, you know, 100, 150 feet off the ground, you look between your legs, and it's just frightening, and you're holding very little things, and even though there's a rope tethering you to somebody above you who's got you on belay, they've got you secure, it's still just one of the freakiest things that's ever happened. And a lot of times, you know, you get what they call a sewing machine leg, and your leg just starts going like this, and your muscles are just tweaked, and, you know, you're just really in trouble. And if you think you're going to fall, which happens, you're supposed to say to the person who's got you on the rope at the other end, you're supposed to look up, and the technical word is you say, tension. And what that support person is supposed to do is to pull the rope tight so on your harness that's around your waist, you feel that tension. Well, every time that I did that and was in a tough place and I thought I was going to come off the rock and fall, I could never remember the word. Ever. I mean, it was just the weirdest thing. And I'm practically wetting myself and I'm like, you know, what's the word? What's the right word to say? And so I would always scream out to my friends, hold me! Hold me! And they would laugh and they would hold me. Guys, this is what we're supposed to say to God. Hold me. God, I cannot make it on my own. I need to find my security in the one who is a fortress and a rock. Would you hold me? I want you to know, men, we were not intended, we were not designed by God to make it on our own. We are designed by Him to be dependent on Him. David made this great discovery that God alone is the one who provides security. And if you're to fight for faith, you've got to make the same discovery in your life. When the troubles come, when the storms come, that this is the one who will hold you, that God alone provides satisfaction and God alone provides security. When I was a young guy, my dad was a vice president of a company called Equity Funding Corporation. Some of you who are in business may remember that name. This goes back quite a few years. As far as business scandals go in the United States, if you read your history book, Teapot Dome was the biggest. The second one was Equity Funding. The third one was Enron, and whatever's going on now in the business world, I don't even get. But those were the big ones so far. Equity and Funding Corporation was a huge company, insurance and securities, huge building in Century City in West LA. My dad was one of 24 vice presidents. There were three presidents of this company, 24 vice presidents. On paper, he had become a very wealthy man. Stock options, everything was in this company. And this is in the era when computers were just getting going. I remember walking in, he took me as a young boy to see this place, it seems so archaic now, but they had a huge room with these huge banks of computers, you know. You could probably put it all on a laptop right now, but at that time, that was just the beginning of computers. And what these three presidents of this company had done is they had somehow figured out how to put bogus policies on their computer bank that made the company look much more solvent, much richer than it really was. The irony is, of course, the company was in really good shape, but they got caught. My dad told me he was in his office one day, you know, way high on this gorgeous building looking out over West LA. And he says, guys came in, Securities and Exchange Commission, with guns drawn. I said, no, Dad, guns drawn? He said, yeah, guns drawn. They came in, they swooped into the building, they cleared out the building, everybody in this building. They bolted the doors, they got it all out, they wanted to get a hold of these computers, they knew what was going on. My dad's stock and all of our family worth in one day, by the time the next day came, that we went from being a family that was in really good shape financially, pretty much set for life, to being in debt because my dad had exercised all these stock options. And we were in trouble. I mean, huge trouble. To the extent that, in short order, we were selling things in our house. I remember my grandfather, who died earlier, had given me a bunch of guns, some shotguns. And I've never been a big gun guy, but they were beautiful old shotguns. And I just loved them, and we sold them because we needed groceries. My mom, who had never worked in her life, went back to work at McDonald's. My dad started scrambling. I was bussing tables as a young guy at a restaurant and eventually became a waiter, and I was bringing home money just to kind of keep it all going. I'll never forget my dad. You know, my dad's kind of my hero. He's still alive. He's a great man. He's 80 years old. In the midst of financial devastation, of going from being pretty much ready to retire, done deal, to not only not having a penny, but to being negative, never fazed him. Never fazed him at all. I can remember, even though as a young guy, I didn't quite get it all. I said, you know, like, Dad, how are you doing? He says, I got a wife, I got you, and we have Reed, too. And he says, I never forget my, he's a big guy, and he puts his arms around me, he says, hey, man, we know God. We're going to heaven. This stuff doesn't matter. David figured it out. My dad figured it out. It was a tough time. He went back to work, took some years to recoup and get a new job and find a new venue. But in the midst of it, there was never a, oh, where's God, and being mad at God. There was a sense that our security is found in a relationship with the God who rules everything. Have you discovered that? Mature Christians fighting for faith realize that our security is in a trustworthy God, who the Scriptures describe as a rock, a fortress, our salvation. Trying to find security in life within ourselves is a mark of immaturity. And if you're going to fight for faith, you've got to get a hold of this one. Not only do you have to have a vision for God's greatness, but you have to have a vision for the security that God alone provides. It's not about you and how clever and strong and together you are. It's about someone else. Our church had a couple of roller hockey teams. I don't know if the roller hockey craze swept in your area, but I played on a roller hockey team with a bunch of guys from our church, and it's really fun. And roller hockey, trust me, is really humbling. There's so much moving. The skates move, the sticks move, the puck moves, everybody else moves, and it's the most humbling athletic endeavor I've ever done in my life. And you know how it is in city leagues, if you're in a softball league or a basketball league, if it's a smaller town or even in your league is not that great, after a while, if you play in that league, you get to know the other teams, right? And so you show up, whether it's a softball game or a basketball game or, in my case, a hockey game, and usually by looking at the other team, since you've played them three or four times in the last year, you know what your night is going to be like. And you know if you're going to win or lose, usually. We show up one night and we're sitting on the bench. The only problem about roller hockey, it takes forever to get all the junk on and it smells really bad. My wife makes me, she says when I come home, you can take it all off, put it in the backyard, don't bring anything in the house or even the garage. So I'm putting all this stuff on with my friends and we're sitting on a bench and it's one of those deals, we're looking at the other bench and they're talking and laughing and slapping and having a great time because they know they're going to kill us. And in our bench, nobody's talking. Nobody's saying a word. Because we know we're going to be in for a long, bad night. It's a bummer. And then he came. Came walking in the back. He's a little late. Game's about to start. He's got a big smile on his face. Our whole bench lights up. Gets a smile, and all of a sudden we got a little attitude going. The other bench looks, and they see the guy coming. His name is Johan. Johan was born in Sweden. Johan played for the Swedish national hockey team. Johan's on my team. I've always remembered that. In a moment, going from frustration, fear, despair, to jubilation, to being encouraged, to having security. Why? Did any of our abilities change one iota? Nope, we were still bad. We were just guys learning a new sport. But because of the presence of another, everything changed. That's what it's like with Jesus. That's what it's like with God. We're not meant to find security in ourselves. David longed for a relationship with God because he made two great discoveries. God alone satisfies our deepest longings. He's the one who provides us the greatest joys in life. And God alone provides security. It's not about us, but it's about Him.